Jonathan Miller is famous for an extraordinary range of successes, including Beyond the Fringe in the 60s, gripping high-minded television series Monitor, The Body in Question and the television Shakespeare among those, and directing daring productions of theatre and opera around the world for 5 decades, while simultaneously keeping up his interest in medicine, especially neuropsychology. He's much loved by many in these different fields, while remaining, equally famously, at daggers drawn with other erstwhile colleagues and, of course, critics. Kate Bassett's eagerly anticipated biography, In Two Minds, published last month by Oberon, is a meticulously detailed, highly readable account of this brilliant, prickly, modern Renaissance man, a cliché of which, needless to say, he's not overfond. Kate is with me, Heather Neal, now at the National Theatre, to give Theatre Voice some insights into her Protean subject. Well, the title, first of all, his dual interest, obviously, science and the arts. But Jonathan Miller's a mass of contradictions of all sorts, isn't he?
Well, he is. I mean, he's a mass of contradictions, but he's also a great connector. To go back to his roots, his father was a doctor and his mother was a novelist, and so there was that split, or you could say marriage, between the science and the arts. And I think he found both attractive, but was indoctrinated by his father with the idea that to pursue medicine was a much more worthy and serious and profound route to take. And so in his later life, he trained as a medic, of course, famously, but then didn't switch, but sort of moved increasingly into theatre and the arts.
While always thinking he was going to go back.
And at points trying to go back. But I think the contradictions, or some of the contradictions, come from that, in that he works in the arts and in many ways has been hugely successful, and yet an inner voice is saying, you're not doing what you should be doing, and that's worthless. And so there are all those conflicts. And at the same time, there's a defensiveness when he's criticised for not doing something good in the arts, and then wants to say, but what I just did was extremely good. And so there's that tension, you know, there's the inner critic, and then the very natural instinct to resist other critics saying, I didn't like that particular show.
Mm. Well, his own title, or at least he came up with a couple of titles, didn't he? One of them was The Main Branches of Arithmetic, which doesn't make a lot of sense until you remember Alice in Wonderland, where the subdivisions of mathematics are ambition, distraction, uglification and derision. Well, at least three of those sound quite apt, in fact.
Well, it's very apt. I think it's rather sweet that was his own suggestion for the title. You know, people tend to think that he's extremely confident and boastful sometimes. But actually, you know, he's got a great sense of humour. He's satirical about others, famously and slatingly. But, you know, there's a level of self-satire as well there, which is rather touching. Yeah. He also said the... another title, he said, oh, what about Best Before, which I've just seen on a sweet wrapper. You know, speaking from old age, looking back on his early career, which is rather sweet.
Well, you mentioned his childhood. His parents came, combined various parts of Europe, didn't they, in their ancestry?
Yeah.
And they were not very... not very hands-on parents, is that right? They were felt a lack of affection.
Yes, I mean he says he was never cuddled. It's interesting because I talked to my parents about that, and they said that their parents were far less hands-on and far less cuddly than they were as parents. You know, in the 60s, it was much more cuddly and warm and affectionate and open. Yeah. So, but I think that is true, and actually. Jonathan's sister, who has since died, but I did interview, confirmed that was true about her parents and that they were quite cold. And I think that has actually profoundly affected him. I don't want to draw a simplistic line between he felt unloved as a child and now when he's unloved by critics, he you know, feels that similar. I don't think that's, you know, he wouldn't probably make that connection. But I can imagine that if you spent your childhood feeling less than loved, it would touch a particularly raw nerve if you in later life felt that too. You know, if you didn't have that confidence in your childhood that you were given lots of affection. And also he talks about at school he was friends with some boys, you know, he was little, 11 or 12 or something, and they suddenly turned on him on a street corner and said, we really hate you. And he really remembers that. And he does actually sort of draw a connection between that and there was a point, say he was in Beyond the Fringe and it was incredibly successful. And even actually, interestingly, if you read his private correspondence with his old friend Oliver Sacks, even while that was happening, he was a bit wary. He was like, the tide's going to turn on this one. I'm getting glowing reviews, but there are going to be bad ones soon. And then he did that in the West End, and that went to Broadway. It was a huge success, came back and started working as a BBC presenter suddenly, and presented an arts programme called Monitor, which he tried to sort of soup up and make more 1960s and trendy, and resisted establishment, got resistance from the establishment, and felt that he was suddenly being condemned. And he does actually compare that to that moment on the street corner. And I think it felt like painfully, suddenly you'd been loved and then you were being slated and you were taken aback by it and bruised by it.
Yes.
But you also asked about his background, his parents and Europe. There's a very interesting, complex background. So his grandparents, in the main, I'm just trying to think, all three out of four came from the Russian Pale of Settlement, Lithuania, and they were Jewish and essentially fleeing anti-Semitic persecution. His maternal grandmother came from Sweden, was of a more successful stock. They were factory owners. They made factory industry clothes. And so there is also in that background a sense of anti-Semitism and persecution that perhaps I think has seeped through. So when he feels persecuted by the critics and things, I think there is a sort of subterranean link going on there. Mm. And he does sometimes talk about the bat squeak, almost inaudible bat squeak of anti-Semitism in Britain. He doesn't overplay that actually about his own life, and he doesn't say critics are anti-Semitic, but he has said that about Private Eye's send up of him. I mean, he suggests that Private Eye is in some way a sort of nest of Christian public schoolboys, and that there's a hint of anti-Semitism. That may be disputable, but that he has said that.
Mm. There's an Irish connection as well, isn't there?
Yeah, his maternal grandfather came from Lithuania. I mean, literally a teenager, jumped on a boat, and he was told by the captain of the ship that they had arrived remarkably swiftly in America, and it was in fact, Ireland. So he got off the boat, and then amazingly, I mean, he was obviously very smart and entrepreneurial. He became the most successful Jewish businessman in Cork. He became a JP. He also played the violin in the orchestra at Cork. He was on the board of a bank there. So he's very assimilated. If you see a picture of him, he's got in the three-piece suit. He married the Swedish woman, and they, because he was a JP, he then actually got into some difficulties with the early Fenian movement. Because he was putting people in prison, and he received death threats. So his wife and kids fled to Sweden for a while, and then he also up sticks, realising that the troubles weren't going to get sorted out. And they then moved to Notting Hill, which is how they got to London.
Right.
And that's how
Jonathan himself seems Jewish, certainly, but also English. I mean, and he went through the establishment system, St Paul's and Cambridge, and his family seemed to have known people who were good contacts from the earliest. I mean, Stevie Smith wrote about him, didn't
he? Yes, I mean, Jonathan would dispute to an extent, dispute that he is Jewish. I mean, because he is not religious at all.
Jewish is
his joke from the Beyond the Fringe. And so it would be quite adamant about that, but is also admires intellectual Jewish culture and enjoyed the Jewish intelligentsia in New York when he did Beyond the Fringe and so on. His mother, Betty Miller, was a sort of minor Bloomsbury novelist, and that's how she knew people like Stevie Smith. So she was writing for the Cornhill and magazine. It's like the intellectual magazines like that. While his father was a founding father, really, of child psychiatry in Britain. He set up the first child guidance clinics based on, partly based on an American model. So they were both sort of high powered in their own fields, and she was a really bright, promising young novelist. Really early on, she was getting acclaimed for her pin sharp accuracy and super sensitivity to. They're a bit like Catherine Mansfield, actually. They're rather good novels, though largely forgotten. And she was also an award winner, an acclaimed biographer. That's what she turned into. She turned away from novels.
She wrote about Tennyson, didn't she?
Yeah, she wrote about Tennyson, and she got early Alzheimer's, really tragically, and had to abandon.
And died very young.
And died very young, 55. Mm-hmm. And so some of the biographical work was actually unfinished.
Mm. I think we can't miss out the incident with which you start the book. Jonathan, aged 13, this quite privileged middle-class schoolboy, busking the queues outside a theatre where Danny Kaye is performing. And it's an indication of his very good ability to take other people off. It's already there.
He is a brilliant
mimic.
A brilliant mimic.
Yeah.
And actually, even earlier than that, he was renowned in his own little circle for his imitation of steam trains, which he still does. And it is phenomenal.
And chickens.
He was very assiduous about just the right clucks and the repetitions. But his steam trains is really unnerving. It is as if there is a locomotive in the room. But anyway, yes, so he was very good at Danny Kaye. And it's interesting because that's exactly what I mean about the split, is that he talks about his parents being very intellectual and quite cold and valuing the life of the mind. And I suspect, actually, I know that they both had a sense of humour and could be quite impish, and his mum's writing is actually very humorous. But the obvious split there is that he was immediately attracted to that golden age of 1950s wartime and 1950s comedy and Light End, and you know, loved all that on the radio, and loved Danny Kaye, who he looked a bit like, and was famous for doing these spoofs of Danny Kaye at school, at prep school and at public school. And he was outside the Palladium, just mucking around with people hanging outside the stage door. And Danny Kaye's manager spotted him, I think, out the window, and thought, God, he's good at doing that. So he actually got Jonathan to come to see Danny Kaye in his dressing room, do the impression of what Danny Kaye thought. And then the really interesting sideline is that Danny Kaye, you know, who had himself played a dream surgeon in films, you know, kind of would that I could be a surgeon, but I never will be. He said, what do you want to do? And Jonathan said, I want to be a doctor. And he said, you'll never do it. Mm. Presumably because he could see that he had this instinct for theatrics and comedy. Mm. And, what a prophecy that was.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what happened.
He remembers.
Yeah, which he does remember, absolutely.
Well, maybe before we get into any detail about his theatre and opera career, and indeed television, there's just so much to him, we should say something about the way you worked. You interviewed him for many hours, obviously, and a whole lot of other people as well. Your acknowledgements are as long as most people's books.
Well, maybe I overdid the acknowledgements. I felt grateful to so many people. I interviewed, I think, about 200 people for it, so it was quite a lot. I mean, what was extraordinary, and I think I'm incredibly lucky, is that he is, firstly, incredibly eloquent, and he loves a chat. And so he was phenomenally generous with his time. I mean, there was one day where I came away after 7 hours of tapes thinking, well, it's going to take quite a long time to type that up, but, you know, wow, that's, you know, I doubt if there are many people who have had that much time given to them for a biography. Mm. And what was so good was not only that he had the patience to really go through his life in detail with me, really all the way through everything he'd done.
He's written some about himself.
He has. He's written some really beautifully written short pieces, mainly about his childhood, about his wartime memories. and this cranky school he went to in between his prep public schools, which he sort of loved as a release. And, you know, they'd get to do mystical paintings in deal with farm animals in their breaks, which he, in retrospect, says was bad for his educational progress, but actually I think quite enjoyed it. But anyway, the other thing is, of course, that he's incredibly eloquent, and so the memories are very vivid and well expressed. But also he has had through his life an extraordinarily vivid memory. So, you know, most people will go, well, I vaguely remember my childhood. But actually he really does remember his childhood in some detail. So that was really enriching. And also, besides that, there was some very interesting research archival material that I found. So he went to St Paul's Boys' School as after the war. And St Paul's has these archival records of all these lunchtime societies. There were debating society, a comedy review society, and a biological field club. And there are records of what the boys were doing, and he's in there, you know. And so you can see the formative Jonathan Miller. So in the debating society, he's sort of mouthing off furiously and being very eloquent and funny at the same time. And you can just see there's a completely direct link there. It's like a sort of Jonathan Miller in miniature.
And this is where he became friendly with Oliver Sacks, a friendship which has continued to this day.
Yes, yeah, there was this extraordinary bunch of... There were six of them, actually. They called themselves the Gang. And they were also split between the sciences and the arts. And so there was Oliver Sacks, and there was another very clever guy called Eric Horn, he went on to write for the TLS and do various literary translations and things. Slightly less famous, but they say he was, you know, if not as brilliant, more brilliant than them. And there were six of them in all, and so they used to have furious debates about whether to go to the National Gallery or the Natural History Museum. And I think they just absolutely sparked off each other and inspired each other. And I think it was a sort of formative moment of, you know, a bunch of bright people actually encouraging each other to be even brighter. Mm. And they all loved... The scientists in the group all absolutely loved this teacher called Sid Pask, who they all sort of see as a formative influence as well.
Yeah.
Who was sort of, you know, they say that he took them to almost university levels of scientific knowledge.
Yes, he must have been an amazing person.
Yeah. I think he was quite shy, you know. I don't think he was sort of a glamorous figure, but I think he was strangely inspiring.
Yes. But this all continued at Cambridge, of course, but... Jonathan had already been at least on the radio, hadn't he, before Beyond the Fringe?
Yes, so he, again, I suppose this is helped by all those sort of, you know, typical public school connections and things, and his mum's connections to Bloomsbury and so on. And so one of her Bloomsbury friends had a husband who worked in the BBC, so that might be how he got spotted. But anyway, he was, as a teenager... on a programme called Under 20 Parade, which was for sort of bright young things, and was on that doing comedy sketches with a friend several times. And then there's this, I found in the BBC written archives, this very funny little letter that he wrote to BBC TV, so he'd only been on radio, in his last year at school, going, I'm 6'4", which might make me unsuitable for the small screen, but I could, however, bend down. And the snotty letter back from this bureaucratic lady going, oh, well, I don't think so. You know, we're really looking for people who will have a career on television. You're thinking, that was a mistake. Yes.
And not just shorter. But then this extraordinary intellectual buzz continued at Cambridge, because not only was he doing his own subject, but he was already lecturing, wasn't he? And was in the Apostles, which is a...
He was in the Apostles. I wouldn't overplay the already lecturing. I mean, I think I found a record in the Cambridge Evening News that he'd gone and lectured on something out in the town.
Was he in the WEA or something?
I'm trying to think what that was to do with. It was one of the societies that he was the...
But he was very interested in philosophy at this point,
His dad was very interested in philosophy and had lots of, you know, Bertrand Russell and stuff on him, and had been taught, had also studied philosophy at Cambridge.
Didn't Jonathan do a famous skit on Russell?
He did.
Even at the Palladium one? Yes, he did. I believe it bombed there.
Yes, it did bomb there.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps.
But he did. It's actually, it was put on vinyl. I found a vinyl copy of it, which is strangely very like Bertrand Russell. If you actually listen to Bertrand Russell, you go, God, it's really not far off. It was a comedy in itself. But yes, he did do that. And he did philosophy as an extra subject, and he did the history. He did history of science, really. As he did extra subjects, and he was doing kind of zoological extra subjects as well as medicine at Cambridge. So he was very wide-ranging then, even then. Mm. And so he was doing a bit of lecturing on the side in those sort of areas, but only a bit. But then he was in the Apostles, which was, it's famous for spies. Guy Burgess and so on, but actually his group were just a very high-powered intellectual bunch, and he talks about it being this very interesting combination of clever intellectual talk but always mixed with humour at that era in the Apostles. And so you can see how that came through as well. So again, humour and comedy is this vein in the way he combines intellect and
And they used to give papers to each other, didn't
yes,
they?
Yes, what happens was, I think they met once a week, and what you did, they had this thing, it's very ritualistic in a way, they have these traditions, what's called the hearth rug, and you go and stand on the hearth rug, and you give your paper, essentially, on something that interests you, and then it's debated. So it was another debating society, but very high-powered, mm-hmm. And with dons as well.
Yeah.
And he describes that as very influential. Though the other side of that is they also had these rules of friendship, which were rooted in it, and that friendship was a very important thing. He talks about feeling guilty of not living up to some of the apostolic values, and one of them is, you know, he feels that he hasn't always kept up his friendship sufficiently, and it suggests that that's slightly from being indoctrinated with that value from the Apostles. Yeah. But he also says that the feeling that he went into showbiz and into a money-earning, you know, world, rather than staying as a scientific and academic researcher, is also against apostolic values, and so feels guilty about that, and feels that...
The Wilcoxes and the Schlegels.
Yes, the Wilcoxes and the Schlegels from Ian Forster, that there are that, you know, you either go into the commercial world and you're slightly tainted by that, or you remain rarefied and intellectual. And so he would draw that comparison with his own career, and claims that he feels worried that those old apostle friends would be looking down their noses at what he did and went into showbiz, though none of them actually seemed to do so.
Well, then Beyond the Fringe happened,
and
that changed his life, really, didn't it? You
it
look doubtful,
did.
Do you think?
Well, it's an interesting slow change.
Yeah.
I think it did, yes, because he had this night in Edinburgh. So it was on at the Edinburgh Festival to start with before it went to the West End of Broadway. And what had happened was he had become a medic. He had qualified. He was working at UCH, the hospital, and was given two, and then had transferred to his next post because he was qualified. He was going through his house jobs. And he was given 2 weeks off to appear in Beyond the Fringe.
Sometimes he was doing them things simultaneously.
Peter Cook, Alan Bennett, and Dudley Moore used to come to the hospital where he was to write the sketches in the room where he would nap when he was on call. Yes, and they would write. I mean, Beyond the Fringe was written in a hospital, which is ludicrous. But he had literally taken 2 weeks off. And you absolutely, at that point, still aren't really permitted to juggle jobs as a medic. Mm. You know, you had to be completely committed. So you couldn't be walking the boards at the same time. And so there was this point where it was at the Edinburgh Festival, and it was obviously a huge hit, and they were already going, it's got to come to the West End. And he had this sort of crisis talk with his wife Rachel, who's already married to you.
Yes, they married very young.
He actually met her when he was still at school.
Yeah.
And they got married almost immediately after he finished at Cambridge. So they walked round and round Castle Rock all night till dawn, going, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep with Beyond the Fringe? And he talks about it and he says, you know, Rachel, in a way, was right, because she said, you won't come back from this. Mm. But she kind of knew that he also, part of him, wanted to do it. Mm. So I suppose you could say that that was the changing point. But he, in himself, kept, you can see from his private correspondence with Oliver Sacks, kept thinking, well, I just keep going. And he actually did keep going in when Beyond the Fringe was in the West End. He was working during the day in hospitals.
Yeah.
Well, but finding it incredibly boring. So he had a job freezing cancer cells, you know, which wasn't inspiring for him. And so he also found the medical profession at that point quite hard to climb the ladder fast. And obviously it was easier if you're becoming a megastar in the West End. Mm. So I mean, he would acknowledge that he was tempted by the ease of that. But he did, you know, he intended to work in hospitals and do some courses in America, but when it went to Broadway, but he didn't.
Yes, he thought about doing that when they were in America. But he did have a very interesting intellectual time in New York, didn't he?
He did. He particularly hooked up with Robert Silvers, who was the guy who had quite recently at that point founded the New York Review of Books. And there was a whole intellectual, sort of broader...
Susan Sontag.
Susan Sontag was a really good friend. And he did actually take her to medical lectures. She was interested in the sciences and the arts, and she actually talked about him being the most, you know, cross-referential person she knew and the most the best connector of the arts and sciences. So yes, and he sort of thrived on that. I think he loved New York, and he sometimes says he kind of wishes he had become an academic in America because he finds it more positive and encouraging and easier to cross the science arts boundaries there. But I think he also feels incredibly English, and he's you know, he had kids here and then felt he couldn't leave Britain for that reason.
I suppose we ought to speed up a little bit. He did get into television despite being so thoughtful.
Yes, he did. He did take a notable leap when he essentially, because he'd earned money from Beyond the Fringe, there are letters where he says, I kind of feel able to abandon the hard graft of the medical idea of climbing up that ladder slowly, and maybe I can do TV programmes or deal with medicine in a broader way. And so he came back and he approached the BBC and, you know, basically knocked on the door and went, is there anything I can do? And at that point, some of the BBC people were planning that he would do science programmes, but actually what he was offered was, unbelievably, do you want to present and produce Monitor, which was this huge arts series.
Yes, I mean, very highly thought of.
Oh, incredibly.
But a bit establishment.
Yeah, run by this Hugh Weldon. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, the mother of all arts programmes.
Yeah.
And so in a way, he just plunged in at the deep end, which has been a pattern in his life as well. He's quite fearless about going, well, I can probably do that.
Yes, when he started in the theatre, he'd never heard of the word blocking, for instance.
No, his first job early on at the Royal Court, yes. And John Dexter, a fellow director, came up and sort of said, have you done your blocking yet? He had this moment of blind panic. I don't know what that is. All the critics are going to go, a shocking failure of blocking, a lack of blocking. What is it? But, you know, he sort of felt his way and felt that he understood why the dialogue was being said or what people meant by it. And he had a certain confidence about it and said he'd self-taught, I suppose. Though most directors are self-taught.
But then he was very hurt when it was very much criticised.
Yes. Yeah, that one got all right reviews, actually, his first one. But then can be very hurt about bad reviews. But in terms of the TV, he actually was more of a TV presenter for a while before. He was gradually moving into theatre, but he, in spite of, got terrible reviews from Monitor. I mean, not across the board, but it did get slated very badly, and he was very wounded by that. But then, interestingly, the BBC were very trusting and very nurturing, and he went straight on from that to do really fantastic screen dramas for them, including there's a one called The Drinking Party, which is a beautiful update of Socrates' philosophical dialogue, and then this fantastic film version of Alice in Wonderland, which is, I think, the best film version of Alice in Wonderland that's ever been done.
Yes, so that's the Alice is extraordinary. Yeah. Let's go into a bit more detail about that. Although the Drinking Party gave his, us his the first time he updated things. That became one of his trademarks, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It's an ancient philosophical dialogue, and what he did was he set it. He set it in the grounds of Stowe Public School in this sort of folly, and all the characters met for a black tie dinner on the at the front of this neoclassical folly. So it's surrounded by fields. So the filming is very beautiful, and you see them arriving through the fields. And the way he structured it was he made it that it was a classics master having a reunion with his ex pupils, and so they were playing out Plato's dialogue as a sort of postprandial.
Isn't this the one where it poured with rain?
It poured with rain during the filming. So what he rather brilliantly did, he sort of put in an interlude with umbrellas and actually used it and then added a bit, hosed them for a bit for extra with watering cans.
Brilliant, yeah.
But it is really beautifully filmed. Partly the cameraman's fantastic as well, but it's it sounds dry, but it's actually looks gorgeous and is rather amusing as well. But Alice in Wonderland was then, it was a really huge event. It was very polemical.
It caused a furore.
It did. There was a debate in Parliament about it before it happened. Yeah. So I suppose he was known as being rather cutting edge from Beyond the Fringe being satirical, and Monitor being shockingly trendy when he took over. And so I think people decided that Alice was going to be some dark, psychologically twisted version of Lewis Carroll. You know, with Lewis Carroll's strange, complex relationship with Alice Liddell. And so there was this furore in Parliament before it even came out, because the BBC had decided it was not really a kiddie version, it was too beautiful and sophisticated, and so they put it on after The Watershed. And so everyone was like, oh my God, it's going to be filth. And so it was actually debated furiously in Parliament, and it ended up being, obviously all publicity is good publicity. So the BBC had to hire some huge cinema for the preview. So many people wanted to come and view it. But then it was, Humphrey, people who run the BBC, Stephen Hurst and people, saw it as a masterpiece, and I think rightly. It's now a DVD made by the BFI, it's a great art house movie from the 60s, really.
And there is psychological interest in it, even though it wasn't travestied as they thought it was going to be.
There is, but it's not sort of a dark Freudian sexual rite of passage or anything. What's actually, for me anyway, as a biographer, more interesting is his mother had developed Alzheimer's and died of it, really, just before that. And what's interesting, if you watch it, is that you can actually see traces of that through it. So Wonderland is a kind of madhouse. So his mum was actually put in essentially a mental asylum. It was called a hospital, but I think it was pretty grim to visit her there. And he found it pretty unbearable, I think. So it was full of senile people gibbering. And actually, some of the scenes in Alice, you can see that there's a scene instead of the Pool of Tears section of Alice in Wonderland, all the characters, the mouse, and it looks like a ward of senile dementia patients, and that's rather interesting. And
was Peter Cook the mad?
Peter Cook was actually the Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter, yes.
Yes, and actually that's...
And Alan Bennett was the Dormouse.
Alan Bennett was the Dormouse. Very funny, sort of sending up Oxford historians, which he himself, of course, was. But actually, the Mad Hatter's Tea Party is based on... He actually deliberately based them on psychiatric cases. They each have a sort of syndrome. And actually, I think that was written about in The Lancet, it was medically informed, and there was a science and psychology in it. But it is interesting, and actually the famous corridor scenes in the film where Alice is running down this really long corridor, and it was actually filmed in a mental hospital. There was a huge mental hospital called Netley that was about to be knocked down, actually, Victorian Mental Hospital, and it was filmed there.
And his father
had worked in psychiatry there.
Yeah.
So, Wonderland as a madhouse was certainly one reading of it.
And Gielgud was in it?
It was unbelievable. Gielgud was in it, Peter Sellers was in it. So many people were in it.
And Malcolm Muggeridge.
Malcolm Muggeridge, yes, with Gielgud on the beach, yeah. The mock turtle was absolutely, and the griffin, absolutely wonderful scene where they're just sort of dancing lightly amongst the waves. And it was Malcolm Muggeridge's acting debut, you know, aged whatever, I don't know, 70 or something. It was very wonderful cast.
Yes, Thomas and Miller has a brilliant eye for people who could do things given the chance, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he does, actually, yeah. And an eye for, strangely in that film, how animal-like those people were, that you sort of suddenly go, yes, John Gielgud is a bit turtle-like.
Yes.
You know, you kind of see all
well,
that.
Well, yes, later on, theatre and opera people said that was one of his great skills, that he could draw out of the actor or the singer qualities which were in the character they were playing.
Yes, they...
I think, you know, before we go into any detail about that, we should stop for a minute, because I think that we're now just getting to the point where we're going to start talking about theatre.
Yeah.
So we'll stop here.